welcome to class. Glad to see you here. I noticed that as of about noon today, 9 of you had submitted homework too. Which, you know, you still got a day and a half for the deadline. And so, great. But anyway, it was a lower number than I expected. Anyway, I hope that's coming along, because we're moving along. I also realize we're going to talk about one little tip that'll give you one of the optional credits in homework 2 today. I had not timed things out right. But we'll mostly talk about ray tracing and homework 3 for most of the day today. And basically that means we're going to talk about math all day long, because that's where we need to start. We may get to some more interesting things like barycentric coordinates at the end. I don't know. We will see. Before we dive in, though, yes. Oh, and the quiz isn't grading correctly. I will fix that when I get back to my office. Sorry, my system is all based on the assumption that at 12:05 on Tuesday I can run all the stats. And it didn't do that. And there's other weirdnesses, like it's saying some questions are 0 points that shouldn't be. So I will fix all that when I get back to my office. Other questions? Yes?
For homework 2, when you're doing the texture mapping,
yeah.
Can we use like an outside library just to load in like the PNG?
Yep. Okay. Reading and writing images is fine, yep. You probably do not want to write a PNG reader by hand. It's not impossible, but it's unpleasant. Other questions? All right. We're going to talk today mostly about intersection. And we're actually going to start talking about segment plane intersection. We'll do other kinds of intersections as we go along. A lot of what we're going to talk about is the math about how you find when two things touch. And this is useful for lots of purposes, like, you know, physics simulation and so on. In some games, knowing if you have hit something, etc. We're going to talk about it in the various graphical contexts, mostly about ray tracing. We're going to start by talking about clipping. And so let us just remind ourselves how a plane is defined. So a plane equation, the plane equation, if you will, ax plus by plus cd, sorry, not cd, plus cz plus d equals 0. This is the standard plane equation. This defines a plane in three-dimensional space. And when we write this plane equation, we often will normalize it in particular ways. So if we think about, I can't draw an infinite plane because there's nothing to draw. But if we draw a chunk of a plane, planes have normals. Okay? And that normal vector is often valuable to understand for a plane. It's useful for lighting, as we talked about when we were talking about lighting. It's also going to be a useful way of storing planes so we can do intersections. And it turns out this normal vector is ABC. Ta-da! So if you have the plane equation, you can get that really easily. And that leaves open the question, what is D? Because X, Y, Z are variables. A, B, and C are the normal of the plane, so what does D mean? And to understand what D means, we're going to talk a little bit about signed direction, or signed distance. So let's suppose I have some point here. Let's use a different color. Let's suppose I have some point P. I want to know how far is P from my plane. How do I figure this out? Well, the basic idea is I pick any arbitrary point on my plane, Q. Doesn't matter what point Q I pick. And I make a vector between Q and P. So Q is any point on the plane. And then if I make this vector, let's call that, how about we call it QP, because it's going from Q to P. Okay? So that vector, we find that vector in three-dimensional space. This is not homogeneous coordinates. Although there's actually a parallel for homogeneous, but it's not important at the moment. And we take that vector and we dot it with the normal vector. That will give me a number. Let's call that number D. Okay? That number D is the perpendicular distance between the plane and P. So that is D, assuming my normal vector was normal. Let's say my normal vector had unit length. So D is equal to the distance times the magnitude of ABC, or of the normal vector, maybe is a better way of writing that. So if I store my plane with a unit length ABC, then this will give me a distance. Now, note, question. Dist dot, that should be a multiplication, I guess. I don't know. I'll draw that. We'll just draw as adjacency. There's too many kinds of multiplication. Okay? So if my and normal vector is unit length, then that's just the distance. Just the distance between P and the plane. But because dot products can have both positive and negative, this is a signed distance. So for P, that will be positive, but if I pick some other thing here, I will find out that its distance is going to be negative. It's going to be positive if I'm in the side the normal points to, it'll be negative if I'm on the other side. And that signed distance is actually usually quite useful. As we talk about signed distances quite a bit in many aspects of graphics, it follows naturally out of our plane equation. And this is often useful for saying something inside or outside or so on. We'll get different ideas of this. So because of this, we're going to store, typically we'll store A, B, and C as a unit vector. And now we can try to derive what D is. D is the distance between the plane and the origin. Right? If 0, 0, 0 is over here, and I go through all of this math, I will find that the distance between 0, 0, 0 and my point is D. And so we can think of this as just saying what direction is the point is the plane pointing in, and how far away is it from the origin with assigned distance, right? It can be in either direction. We don't usually need to worry about how we compute D, because often we'll actually store planes with points instead of the whole plane equation. But we can jump back and forth between them relatively easily, because we need a normal vector, and then we just got one more number. So if I know the normal vector, I pick some point on the plane, I can solve for D fairly easily. So we can get our plane equations relatively easily, given that we have some other information. Going from plane equation to points on the plane is slightly more complicated, because there's so many points on the plane. And you have to pick one. But usually we start with points in graphics, and we derive the plane from it, not the other way around. Question about our plane equation or signed distance? All right, let's talk then about segment plane intersection. So a segment is defined by two points. Okay, so you have two points make up a segment, and then I have some plane. Okay, and I want to know where does this segment bump into the plane? Where is that point of intersection where it crosses over? I want that point. Now, the first thing we can observe is that point needs to be a linear combination of P1 and P2. It lies on the line between it. So this point here, let's just call it P. P is going to equal alpha P1 plus 1 minus alpha P2 for some alpha. By nature of being on that line, there has to be a linear combination that will find me that point. And it turns out that linear combination, that alpha, is really easy to find. Okay? All I need to do is I need to find distance 1 and distance 2 from the plane using our signed distance. Notice one of these will be positive and one of them negative if we have an intersection. So if they're both positive or both negative, there's no intersection between the segment and the plane because they're both on the same side of the plane. The sign of the distance tells me what side I'm on. So to have an intersection, I have to be on different sides. So if they have different signs, then alpha is going to be based on those two. Now, there are various ways of deriving this, but just intuitively, if D1 was 0, what should alpha be? One. Right? If this point is no distance from the plane, then this point is the point on the plane. So as D1 goes to 0, alpha should go to 1. As D2 goes to 0, alpha should go to 0. Okay? And so we want to create some linear system like that. This turns out to have a relatively simple form. It's just D2 divided by D2 minus D1. This equation is, some people find it counterintuitive. So the thing I multiply P1 by is D2. It's how far away the other point is. Because the farther the other point is, the more this point matters. Also, we have this subtraction because these should have different signs. So there's two possible cases here. Either D2 was positive and D1 was negative. In which case, you have a positive divided by a positive minus a negative, or positive over positive, so we'll get a positive there. Or maybe I had a negative, negative, positive. In which case, I have a negative divided by a negative minus a positive, which is negative over negative, which is also positive. So it doesn't actually matter which sign was which. I will always end up with a positive alpha, which is good, because I want to end up having a positive level of this point in the equation. And so for R, it doesn't matter which orientation the plane had, as long as these two, D1 and D2, have different signs, this will find the point at the intersection of the plane. And in extra propinquity, this will find it to within the precision of the numbers we are using. This is one of those times when floating point arithmetic actually works, not just almost works. Not that that matters a great deal, but we can find it with great precision here. Question about this approach? Yes?
When you say distance to a plane, is the minimum distance to a plane?
It is the...
The point that would give you the smallest value, is that...
Yes, the distance between a point and a plane is the distance between the point and the closest point on the plane.
Yeah, okay.
Other questions? All right, we can use this to do polygon clipping. So often when we're, not hugely often, but sometimes when we're drawing things, we want to draw only portions of a scene. Maybe we want to make a cutaway view, maybe we want to remove a lot of stuff that isn't interesting, maybe we're playing some game where you have some special gun that allows you to shoot holes through objects and walk through them, right? Whatever it is you're doing, there's sometimes when we want to be able to clip away portions of the scene. There are lots of ways of doing this. Sometimes we do it per pixel, something called a stencil buffer, which is basically a depth buffer that's either all the way close or all the way far away. We just remove individual pixels from the scene. But we can also do it geometrically with the polygons themselves. So we can have clipping planes in our scene. So how do we clip a triangle? I have a triangle, I have a clipping plane. Well, all I have to do is first notice there are three segments in a triangle. So I'll just clip each of the segments. Because I'm clipping it against a plane, and because triangles cannot be non-planar by nature of being made out of only three points, I am guaranteed to get one of two scenarios. Either two of the edges have intersection, or none of them do. I can't get all three having intersections unless one of the intersections is actually one of the vertices, which is, we can sort of pretend one of the intersections wasn't there and it will work out fine. Okay? So I either get two intersections or none. If there's no intersections, okay, so if I have some triangle, let's say I have my clipping plane is here, I want to keep this side and I want to discard this side. Okay, so I'm removing half of the world. Make my intersection match up with the plane I drew. Okay, a triangle over here, we discard the whole thing. No intersections, and we'll typically say this is like the positive and negative side of the plane. Here I'm assuming the plane is coming out of the screen, so it has no depth. It'll make our lives a little easier. Okay, so if it's on the negative side, that means all three of the points have a negative distance. If they all have negative distance, I throw away the whole polygon. If all three points have a positive distance, I keep it as is. If some have positive and some have negative, then I need to clip. Okay? And there's actually two cases I could have there as well. I could have one pixel has, one vertex has positive and two have negative, or one has negative, two has positive. The one positive, two negative, I find these 2 points and I throw away the rest of the triangle. Okay? And so one triangle turns into one triangle. In doing this, I want to know what is the color and the texture coordinate and all of the other information for those intersection points. Fortunately, the way we did segment intersection has a linear combination. We do that same linear combination for all of the aspects of the point. Okay? So here we're doing this with x, y, z, r, g, b, etc. Everything we know about it can all be portion of this math here. And so we'll get all of those values correctly for those points, and it will look like a nice clean cut with no random artifacts. When we clip and there are 2 points on the inside, it's no longer a triangle. And that causes some problems, because most ways of drawing shapes that have more than 3 vertices do not interpolate things across the middle very well. We can actually do a quad with 4 vertices pretty well, but then what if there's another clipping plane that clips that from a quad into a pentagram or whatever, right? We can keep cutting with more than one clipping plane. So what we really do is we just arbitrarily repolygonalize. So we just pick some arbitrary way of chopping that quad into 2 triangles. Which one? Doesn't matter. There's only 2. Pick one. There is some argument to be made for trying to pick the one that does not go through the smallest face angle, but this really doesn't matter. In most contexts, we just pick one at random. Question?
So do we pick the two points that are non-adjacent when you construct that triangle, those 2 triangles?
If you pick points you're adjacent, you still have a quad.
Oh, I meant like when you're repolygonalizing.
Yeah, when we turn a quad into triangles, they have to be opposite vertices. Because otherwise it doesn't turn to triangles. It turns into a line segment and a quad, which is what we started with. Yeah, so there's 2 possible ways of doing that. And you pick one. And away you go. And then if you have more clipping planes, you do this for one of them, and then you do it for the next one, and then you do it for the next one, and you may end up with a lot more triangles, right? In general, each clipping plane could double the number of triangles. It usually doesn't, but it could, right? And you can construct a pathological scene where 8 clipping planes causes you to have 200 times more triangles than 0 clipping planes, because each one doubles, right? It's very uncommon for that to be the case. Usually this mostly throws things away and saves you work in the long run. But sometimes it adds a lot of work because you create a whole lot of things along the way. And this is clipping planes. Clipping planes are sometimes done with homogeneous coordinates instead of geometric coordinates. Almost all of the math just works. Because as we started out here, we started by taking differences, right? To find our distance, we took a dot product with a normal. The normal will have a 0 in the w coordinate, so the dot product will get rid of the w. Anyway, most of this math just works in homogeneous coordinates as well, allowing us to, for example, cleanly clip against frustums and so on. And so it can be done before or after divide by w with essentially the same results. Any questions about clipping? Yes?
So yep. One part where you say like OpenGL does frustum clipping, but we don't do that. So does that mean like the near point of the frustum would like clip the triangle?
Yep. Yep. So it is OpenGL behaves as if, but does not necessarily use clipping planes to do. It behaves as if that frustum is made out of 6 planes and I clip against all of them before I draw. Now it turns out, I should say, OpenGL 1 and 2 did this. OpenGL 3 lets you pick. But conceptually, we have a bunch of planes, each of which is pointing in, right? And we clip against the 6 of them before we draw. In practice, it often turns out to be easier to do this in hooking something into your rasterizer. Okay? So I think there is the efficient screen clipping is one of the options for the homework. What does that mean? If I have some giant triangle and I have a screen here, okay? Our DDA algorithm with a very little tweak will only paint the part of the triangle that's in the screen. And what's that very little tweak? It's that initial offset. Instead of having initial offset to a pixel, have an initial offset to a pixel in screen. So we just add up to the bottom of the screen, and then when we go across horizontally, add over to the left side of the screen, and then we get out of the screen, we stop iterating. Okay? So you can actually take your DDA algorithm with just a handful of tweaks to the lines of code, you can make it rasterize as if we had clipped to the frustum. And then as far as the near and far plane, you can do that by some little tricks when you're going to your depth buffer. And so in practice, a lot of implementations didn't do clipping planes to clip for frustums, although some did. There's differences in performance depending on what part of your graphics pipeline is fast. Question?
So I guess what's the difference between, like, is there any practical difference besides like just the speed it runs between this idea and the per pixel clipping? That's required.
So the per pixel clipping will generate all of the pixels and throw almost all of them away because they're off screen.
Okay.
An efficient screen clipping will jump two pixels that are in screen and not generate the rest.
But the per pixel clipping is effectively doing the frustum clipping.
They're all doing something like frustum clipping. They're all not drawing pixels off the screen. Right? So you could do this by physically chopping our triangle into smaller triangles until we have triangles only fit in the screen. We could do this by generating only the pixels on the triangle that are in the screen. We could do it by generating all of the pixels and throwing most of them away. The only one of those that's notably inefficient is generating all of the pixels and throwing them away. So I don't know if any of you have tried without doing anything special to try to run the screen clip input. Did anybody have it run in less than 10 minutes? Yeah. So it's not hard to make something with a very small w that becomes this absolutely gargantuan triangle that has billions and billions of pixels and your code times out, right? And so some level of efficiency is needed for any real implementation to avoid that problem, although it's an elective for what we're doing. Other questions about clipping? All right, a lot of this math is also going to work for ray tracing. And so let's just talk about the concept of ray tracing. We mentioned the concept of ray tracing some time ago. We were comparing it to the concept of rasterization before we spent way too long talking about how to generate pixels. So let's just remind ourselves of the principle. Okay? We imagine in ray tracing that there is some point and some raster. We can actually do this in other ways. We'll talk about other projections later. But the basic idea is I have my eye, I have my pixel coordinate, so I have my pixel, and then I have the stuff out in the world. And what ray tracing does is for each pixel, it is going to generate a ray. A ray is the thing that isn't on the segment or a line. It's infinite in one direction and not in the other. So it has a starting point but no stopping point. This is the mathematical definition of a ray. So a ray has an origin and it has a direction. We generate this ray and then we try to find the thing in the world that bumps into first. And then we say, what color is that thing it bumped into first? And we draw that color in the pixel. And we use for every pixel in the scene. This is the core idea of ray tracing. It turns out the ray tracing lets you do really fancy ways of asking the question, what color was that pixel? And we'll talk more about those on Tuesday. But for now, let's ask the question, how do I know what I bumped into? Okay? And so what this entails, the basic approach of ray tracing, let's try a little pseudocode here. Okay? We do for each pixel, we make a ray for that pixel. And then we do for each object, we find an object ray intersection. And we remember the closest. And then, I shouldn't have put this on top of everything else, but oh well, I will anyway. And then we draw that color.
What does it say under find object ray?
Remember closest. There. This is the pseudocode, right? So for every pixel I generate an array, for every array I look at every object, and figure out which one's closest. This has bad asymptotics. Right? So if I have, let's say a 1024 by 1024 screen, so I have a million pixels, and let's say we have 100 objects, then I have to do, and each object is made out of 1,000 polygons. I'm going to do this computation for every polygon, for every pixel, for every, and very quickly, this can take forever and a day. However, this is the classic example, this is the naming example of what we call embarrassingly parallel. Embarrassingly parallel. So I realize that the way we currently teach CS, you can get all the way up to here and not really know how to write parallel code. And first off, my apologies for our failing you as a curriculum. But the core problem with parallel code is that splitting off and doing multiple things at once is easy. Getting them all back together again to decide what we've learned is hard. Okay, so it's the coordination that's complicated in parallel code. There is almost no coordination here. There is no correlation between pixels. So I can trivially generate a different parallel computation for each pixel in the scene, because there's nothing shared. And so that very quickly gets me million-fold parallelism with no overhead besides generating the different threads or processes or computers to do the work. And then within each of them, there's very little parallelism needed for remembering the closest thing. We can put that into some sort of logarithmic combination queue. There's different very efficient ways of combining this kind of work, where we do a lot of math to find intersections, and we end up with just a number, and we want the closest one. Okay? And so the combination is very simple compared to the work we're doing. And so we can realistically do this with many billion-fold parallelism, getting high efficiency out of all of it, if you have a billion computers. Okay? Of course, you don't. You probably only have a few thousand. You probably do have a few thousand, although you may not realize this. Your GPU probably has a few thousand processors. And so using GPUs to do ray tracing is a developing, maturing space. It's still not what they're primarily doing. They're primarily doing a slightly less parallel task of you could rasterize each triangle by itself and use the depth buffer as the thing that combines them. But this is embarrassingly parallel. In theory, this could eventually run faster than everything else because it's more parallel if we get enough processors engaged. And so you have things like render farms. A render farm is what we used to call data centers before we had the name data center. Right? It used to be the only reason you would want a whole lot of cheap computers was to draw a whole lot of pixels for some movie. And so people buy tens of thousands of old computers and put them in a giant warehouse and make pictures and sell movies and become rich, right? Anyway, we realized we can do this with other things since then, but this is sort of one of the earliest cases of that. But we're not going to talk about how to parallelize them in this class because I don't want to spend time talking about synchronization, especially in eight different languages. So we're just going to talk about what each of these things does here, right? The crux of this, the hard part of this is find object ray intersections. And so we're going to talk about probably just two of the three common algorithms here, because the third one I hope you can learn pretty easily if you know those two. Basically, there are two things we intersect, spheres and triangles. Spheres because we can and they look cool, triangles because artists create them. And so we're going to talk about how both of these work. We could do similar work we do for spheres for other geometric shapes. So you can actually find ray tracers that do toruses and solenoids and so on. But we're just going to do spheres and triangles. So we're going to start with triangles. So how do I intersect a ray with a triangle? I do this in two steps. Okay? So to intersect a ray with a triangle, I first do a ray with the plane the triangle is in, and then I check to see if it's inside. Okay? So the ray plane intersection is where we start. Ray plane intersection is a lot like segment plane intersection. slightly more complicated to describe because we only have one point, not two. We could use, so how do we store array? Let's start with that. What is array? Array, we said, is an origin and a direction. Okay? The origin is a point. The direction is a vector. Or, yeah. We usually do these, usually ray tracing does not use homogeneous coordinates. And so we usually don't have to worry about what I mean by vector. But I mean the direction kind of vector, not the offset kind of vector or the point kind of vector or the arbitrary list of things kind of vector. Anyway, so we have a point and a vector. Let's call that O and D. Why not? You don't have to normalize the direction vector, but commonly we will. And so I'm going to assume our direction vector is of unit length because it's going to make a little bit of our math slightly easier. Most of the math here doesn't care. And in the implementer's guide, we go through all these equations without assuming we have normal length vectors. So you can see where that matters there. But so I have that, and then I have a plane. Now, because I have a plane made out of triangles, I actually have three vertices. So the first thing I need to do is get the plane equation from three vertices, or at least get the plane's normal. The plane's normal is easy to get. Let's call this P0, P1, and P2. To get the plane's normal, I just take a cross product. Okay? So the normal vector is going to be P1 minus P0 crossed with P2 minus P0. And then I'll typically make it unit length by dividing it by its own magnitude. Again, unit length just makes things easier. This is computation. This is a square root and a division, which is more expensive than other things, and so we sometimes try to get away without doing that, but I'm just going to assume we have. Okay, so if I have a normal vector, and I have an origin and a direction and points on the plane, I now want to find out the intersection, this point right here. That's my goal. What is Q? Okay? Q is a very specific point. Q is on the ray, which means it equals O plus TD for some T, where T is how far into the scene it is. We actually need how far it is into the scene it is, because that tells us which of the object is closest. So we actually want T, as well as where it's located in the scene so we can light it. Okay? So we want to know what T is. We could derive T once we know the point, but it's actually easier to find T and get Q out of that. So we want to find T. We know that there's a T because it's on a coordinate plane, and we also know that it's the case that QX times NX plus QY times NY plus QZ times NZ plus some other thing we haven't defined yet, I'll call it M, equals zero. Because this is the definition of a plane equation. Okay? Note here that this is just Q dot N. Okay? And I haven't told you what M is yet. It's the other constant in the plane equation. But I want Q dot N plus M to equal something. And what is that M? Well, that M is the thing that make all three of these points have zero. So M is, by definition, the negative of P, not Q, of P0 or P anything, P0 dot N. It's also the definition of P1 dot N and P2 dot N, because these will all be the same number. And I want that to be the case because I want these points to have zero distance from the plane. And that's how I do it. Okay? And so now I just have a linear system of equations. My Q's are defined in terms of O and D, which are constants and known, and I have a T, and I solve for T. Okay? And we could push through all of the ways of doing this. Fortunately, we don't need to, Because I'm feeling slightly ill, we'll probably make some int mistakes, but that's all right. The implementer's guide, I wasn't feeling ill when I wrote it. At least I don't think I was. It's been a long time. Okay, and so here is the math. Work through it, ray plane intersection, here it is. Okay, so we say here we have the plane's definition, and here we have the distance, and finally we have this equation right here. Boom, there it is. Okay, notice here, there are some nice pieces of this. We have n top and bottom, so if n was not normalized, it didn't matter. Because if it was multiplied by a constant, we multiplied numerator and denominator, so poof, n's unit length didn't matter. All we are doing is subtraction and dot product. Beautiful, those are efficient operations. So basically all we have to do is a few subtractions, a few multiplications, one division, and we're done. As we get this t very efficiently. I've used slightly different names here. I think I used ro instead of r. MP to be a point on the plane, and RD instead of D. But we have this equation, and you can, there's lots of ways of getting here. You can get through it through linear substitution. You can try thinking more in terms of vectors. You'll get here either way. And that gives you the point of intersection, because I know Q at T, I can discover Q, and then I can ask myself, is Q inside the triangle? Questions about this equation? Yes?
You said RO was R bound up R1.
Is O. Origin, direction. Sorry, this is a picture that tries to show you everything under the sun, including both sphere and plane intersections, and yeah, sorry. Yep. So where I have O, that has RO for each of these, and RD. Instead of D, and so on. Okay? And so we can derive this T and find out where it is. Now, there's a few things to think about this T. If T is less than or equal to 0, then the intersection was behind us. And we typically don't draw stuff behind us. Okay? So this is something we have to think about. There is stuff behind us, and this equation will give us a distance, and it will be negative, and we don't want to draw that stuff. It's behind us. If we do find a positive, we now need to know, is it inside the triangle? So we're going to move on to that here in a moment. Before I do that, any questions about the ray plane part of ray triangle intersection? Yes?
So are we seeing that P0, P1, P2 are kind of clockwise?
For this equation, it doesn't matter. I mean, that is the normal I have. That's just the normal is pointing out. Yes, that's what I'm assuming here for the way I wrote this. But if my normal is pointing the other direction, because in the end it's in the numerator and denominator, if it was negative one of what it is, it would be the same thing. Yes?
Shouldn't you not find t less than or equal to 0 practically because you're always shooting away from the I?
Yeah, but how do I know what objects are in front of me?
By the definition of like the pixel plane, the plane of pixels.
Yeah, but in the end I'm just doing math, right? So this is the math that tells me t. So, and notice that p and n are based on the object. So how do I know for any given object if I should run this equation or not? And the answer is, I could figure it out, but it's faster to run it for everything, because just a few multiplies, see what sign it gives me, and if it gives me negative, say it was behind me, I shouldn't have done that. In other words, right, I have defined Q as being O times TD. But that works for negative T. So this is actually an equation of a line. But I only wanted it to be a ray, so if it tells me a negative t, that was the wrong half of the ray. That was the part of the line that wasn't part of the ray, so we ignore that. You still look puzzled.
I understand.
Okay. Other questions? All right. So find a ray plane intersection. I get a t, and from the t I can get a q, the point of intersection. I now need to know, was this inside the triangle? And if I'm interpolating anything like color or texture coordinate, I need to know where inside the triangle was it. And this gets us to what are called barycentric coordinates. In geometry, there are lots of things about triangles and simplices and higher dimensions, and there's lots of coordinates about space and so on. The basic idea of barycentric coordinates in geometry is if I have some triangle with vertices A, B, and C, any point that I might care to pick, okay, I can represent P as something times A plus something times B, not that, plus something times B plus something times C, where these three things, where alpha plus beta plus gamma equals 1. Okay, and there is only one way of doing that for any point in space. This is a coordinate system. It's a constrained coordinate system because I've got three coordinates but only 2 degrees of freedom. And furthermore, so I can find this for any point, and then I know that P is inside the triangle if alpha is greater or equal to 0 and beta is greater or equal to 0 and gamma is greater or equal to 0. So if I can do this for positives of these three, then it's inside the triangle. Now, if you learn this in geometry, they will teach it to you as one of those weird things we can prove, and then let's move on with our lives. This turns out to be the thing we want when we are doing ray tracing for triangles. Because alpha, beta, gamma give us linear weights of the vertices that we can then use to take linear weights of their texture coordinates or their colors or their normals or whatever else we know about them. This allows us to interpolate arbitrary information if we can find these three magic numbers. There are lots of ways of finding these three magic numbers. They will tell us if something's inside or not, and if it's inside, it'll tell us where they are. The easiest way to find these three magic numbers computationally is to pre-prepare our triangle. So, what do I mean by pre-prepare our triangle? Okay, so I have P0, P1, and P2. I'm going to generate three extra vectors for each of the edges. Okay? So let me just talk about what these are first, and then we'll talk about how we use them. Let's say we have this E2 vector. So we're going to have a vector that's perpendicular to each edge and points to the opposite vertex. It is traditional to name these based on the name of the opposite vertex. Okay? And because it is perpendicular to an edge, if I were to take some point here, Q, and I were to take a vector, P0 to Q, and I would take the dot of that and the edge 2, that will be 0 along this edge and get bigger as I get towards P2. Because the dot product tells me the distance of a vector projected onto another vector. And so as I'm if Q is along this bottom edge, that will be 0 for all points along that bottom edge. As I get closer to P2, it will get a larger and larger value. And if I pick the right magnitude of E2, I can make it be 0 down here and 1 up here. In other words, I can make this dot product be one of my barycentric coordinates. Okay? So how do I do that? What is E2 to make this magic happen? So I'm going to take my E2 vector. Okay. First, I need something perpendicular to P0, P1 that lies in the plane, because this is 3D. So I'm going to take a vector that connects those. So I'm going to take this edge vector, and I'm going to take the cross product of that and the normal vector. Okay. So that will give me something that's in the plane. It's in the plane because it's perpendicular to the normal vector by virtue of cross product. It's perpendicular to this edge vector, again, by virtue of the cross product. So it's pointing either in or out of this edge. and has some arbitrary length. I don't actually care what's pointing in or out, and I don't care what length it is, because we're going to fix that. Okay? So let's call this E2 prime, because this is not the one we're really going to use. E2, the one that's the right length, is going to be a normalized version of E2 prime. So it's going to be E2 prime, and then I'm going to divide it by. And what do I divide it by? I want to make sure the E2 dot P2, or E2 dot the vector between P0 and P2, is 1. So I'm going to figure out what my old dot product was and divide by that. So I'm going to divide by P2 minus P0 dotted with E2 prime. I always have a feeling when I'm talking about vectors that I've lost most of the room before I started. Yes?
I missed which two things you were getting the dot product of.
E2 prime and the vector between P2 and P0.
I think we're dotting P0 Q with P2 and P2.
Ah, I use it by dotting P2 P0 Q, but I find it by dotting P2 P0. Yeah.
Can you explain why that part you just wrote is P2 minus P0?
Yes. What vector would, how would I draw P2 minus P0 on this picture? It's this vector right here, ending at P2. Okay? If I take the dot product of that and whatever my E2 prime was, let's say this was E2 prime. Let's suppose I got it going the wrong direction. Then it will be this negative, it'd be whatever the signed distance between this edge and that point is. If I divide by that, I guarantee that signed distance will become 1. And then, for once I have this for any q, if I take q minus either p0 or p1, doesn't matter, dotted with e2, this is going to give me a barycentric coordinate. It's going to give me the barycentric coordinate of P2. It's going to be the influence of P2 on that point. And then I can generate similar E's for the other two sides. And the computation of E does involve a division, but I only have to do it once per triangle. So I can do this as a pre-processing step. I'm going to give you all these vectors for all of my triangles, store them in my triangles, and then for each individual intersection, after I find T, I find the point, I run these dot products. If they're all positive, I have the barycentric coordinates. If any one of them is negative, I don't have an intersection. I have a lot of, maybe I'm misreading faces. I have a lot of looks of, that's magic, I wonder if it really works. Yeah, Yeah.
So, will we do this? You said we do it once per triangle?
We generate these in advance.
The E's.
All three of them.
Why do we need all three? There's only 2 degrees per E.
You only need two, but it's actually faster to compute with three dot products than two dot products, and then some math to figure out the other.
Would you just subtract it?
Yeah, I guess you could do that. And that may actually be faster in some cases. It's a little less parallel, but you probably aren't spawning a thread to do this, so you're probably okay there. Yeah. Other questions? Yes? So the barycentric coordinates tell us two things. First off, they all have to be positive for the point to be inside. And so if there any of them are negative, I don't have a real intersection with the triangle, just the plane the triangle is in. So that is useful for knowing, do I have an intersection at all? Okay. And then, if they're all positive, they also tell me the weight of whatever I'm interpolating. So if their vertices are different colors, or different texture coordinates, or whatever, these barycentric coordinates give me how much to combine the different vertices values. Other questions? Incidentally, if you're really interested in efficiency, by definition of these adding up to 1 and all having to be positive, that means they all also have to be less than or equal to 1. And it turns out that for any given triangle, one barycentric coordinate being between 0 and 1 gives you this narrow band of the universe. And so by checking one of these, you can throw out most cases of non-intersecting. And so checking both a positive and negative of 1 can give you an almost threefold speed increase in your triangular intersection. Anyway, mostly an aside. But there's fancy things you can do if you think about carefully about geometry and making things faster. Yes?
How do you find alpha and beta gamma based on U1 U2?
Yeah. Alpha is, in this case, it would be, so I said alpha is weighed by A, so this would be P minus B dotted with my EA vector. And this could just as easily have been C. It doesn't matter whether that's E or C, it just means B or C, it just matters that it's not A. And similarly for beta gamma. Other questions? All right, yeah?
You said we compute these in advance.
The E vectors we typically compute in advance.
Okay, so is that just like at every ray tracing stage, or just like?
So typically what you would do is you would read in the geometry. You compute lots of stuff about the geometry. You usually compute the surface normals and the E vectors, and you may do some other optimizations first, and then you'll start your ray tracing. Notably, unlike rasterization, because ray tracing has to know what's the closest object for everything, we don't start any of our ray intersections until we know all of the geometry. So it isn't a single pass like the rasterizer was. It's you load in all the geometry, you compute all the work you want to do in all the geometry, and then you start all your ray tracing. Yes?
If you were splitting this up, making this parallel,
yeah.
Could you do the barycentric coordinates? If you do that before you actually split up the work,
yep.
How would you do that?
So you pre-process the geometry, you'd add some vectors to every triangle, yeah. And then you'd fork your threads.
Okay, so you'd have to do it afterwards.
The process of pre-processing geometry is such a tiny part of the work that it's usually not worth trying to parallelize, unless there's an unbelievable amount of geometry. Which sometimes there is, but that's a side note. Okay. All right. So that's triangles. They're one of the two things we like to draw. Now, the other thing we love drawing in ray tracers is spheres. I haven't tried this in a while, but I'm guessing, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm going to say I want a ray traced scene in an image search. And let's see, spheres, only cylinders, spheres, only polygons. Okay, so only the first 2 of 5 had spheres. We're starting to see some more non-spheries. There's toruses, which are also, spheres, okay. We just have a lot of spheres. We know how to do spheres. We're really good at spheres. And they're enclosed objects. We're good at planes too, but that's not as interesting because they're huge, right? And triangles, we know how to do that in other systems. But spheres, we don't know how to do well in rasterizers, and we do know how to do them well in ray tracers. So we do a lot of spheres in demo scenes. You can also use them for water droplets and things, but they show up much less often in art than you would expect based on how much we talk about them. Yes?
Does ray tracing make bubbles easier?
If they're spherical. it makes the refraction of light in bubbles much easier. So you almost never will see refraction in a rasterized scene. And we'll talk more about how refraction works later. I think on Tuesday, actually, we're scheduled to do that. Okay, so how do we compute a ray sphere intersection? Ugly math. Okay, brace yourselves for more vectors. All right, so I still have my origin and my direction, and I have a sphere. How is a sphere defined? It is defined by a center and a radius. And what am I looking for? I am looking for, in this ray, what is the close point that I bump into the sphere. Notably, I either don't bump into it at all or I bump into it twice with a singularity if I'm tangent. Okay? But in general, there's either two or zero intersections. And what else has two or zero intersections you learned about in grade school? All quadratics, right? The quadratic form, you know, has that beautiful plus or minus thing. And so guess what? We're going to find out this is a quadratic. And we're going to get there, okay? Quadratic formulas, though, square roots, ugh. Vectors are so much more beautiful, we're going to try to use them, okay? If we can avoid doing square roots, we save ourselves time. We'll need them eventually, but we're going to try to make them as late as we can. So, the process here. And I'm going to walk through this process mostly because this is also how you derive it for anything else. So if at some point, years down the road, you're being asked to make, you know, the correct ray tracing algorithm for the weird geometric formula X, this is how you go about it. You just start working through and finding things you can find that get you closer to the answer using a lot of similar triangles. Similar triangles are the salvation of ray tracing. So what can we do first? Well, I know how to find the vector between the origin and the object. I can find this vector from O to C. That's subtraction. I can do that. Okay? If I can find the vector from O to C and I have the ray direction, then I can find the dot product of those to find the closest point on the ray to the center of the sphere. So this point here, let's call that Q. Q is going to be the origin plus the direction times, and then I'm going to have the direction vector dotted with the OC vector. And why does this work? The dot product, in addition to finding cosines, it also finds the projection of one vector along another. So this dot product tells me how far down D do I have to go to get as close to C as I can get. So if I multiply that by D, I go that far and I find that point. Okay, so I can find that point. I also know how far that was. And now I've got what I can do without using similar triangles and trig. So similar triangles and trig to the win. How do we use this? Okay. I know that this distance here is r. And I just found this distance. Because I know q, I can find this distance. Let's call that, let's call that m. How about m? Okay, how do I find m? Well, m squared is easier to find than m. M squared is going to be QC dotted with QC. When you dot a vector by itself, you end up with the square of its magnitude. So M squared is QC dot QC, where Q is this point and C is that point. We add, subtract them to find the vector between them. And M squared, from m squared and r squared, I can find r by squaring it, and the hypotenuse formula, I can find this other thing. Let's call that n, why not? So n squared plus m squared, oh, not m cubed, m squared, has to equal r squared, which means that n squared equals r squared minus m squared. Okay? And this is actually already enough to know if I've hit the triangle or not. I will have missed the triangle if n squared is negative. As you think about it, the farther away, and we could also do it by comparing m squared to r, that would also work, okay? But as m gets bigger, n gets smaller until we hit the edge, and then we'll get a negative. And so if n squared is negative, there's no intersection. I missed the sphere. I managed to get here with only doing subtractions, multiplications, and additions. No square rooting for the win. All right. But then if I do have an intersection, then I need to figure out where that intersection is. That's actually fairly straightforward too. Notice this dot product here, let's call that, let's call that TC. So that was how far I went to get halfway through the circle. TC, okay? And if I now know N, then T, which gets me right to the edge, that's the thing I want to know. T then is going to be TC, which I've already computed with the dot product, minus the square root of N squared. And with T, I have everything I need. Questions?
TC is just...
TC is this dot product.
Okay.
It is the distance to the halfway point of the sphere. Or the halfway through the secant, I guess, of the sphere.
So T is a scalar, right? So you have to do like the origin plus T times.
Right. So this is just how far along the ray I go. But I actually want that information. Because that tells me in my pseudocode closest. That means I want those T values. So I also want to know where I hit it, but I want to know those T values, and so getting those along the way is useful for the ray tracing algorithm. All right, now I said there's two solutions. What's the other solution? It's plus square root instead, right? And if we really work through this, we could realize this is a version of the quadratic formula. I have plus or minus square root, just like we expect for quadratic formulas. When do I want the plus solution? I want the plus solution, yeah.
When square root of n squared is bigger than 2c, so like if the quote-unquote near side of the sphere is behind the origin.
Then I must be inside the sphere,
yeah,
and want the far side of the sphere. Okay? There are other ways to find this. If TC is smaller than R, I will be in that position. There's a handful of, if T is smaller than R. Anyway, there's other ways of computing this. If OC's length is less than R, there's various things we can do here to figure this out. But in the end, if I'm inside the sphere, I want the far solution. If I'm outside the sphere, I want the near solution. Usually we think of ourselves as being outside spheres. But not always, because we could, for example, model the sky as a sphere. And we're inside it, right? Or we could decide to try to render something inside a dome or so on. So sometimes we're on the inside. More likely we're on the inside because we're shooting rays through objects and out the other side. We'll talk some about that on Tuesday. But this is the other main solution we have. Okay? Questions about ray sphere intersection? I should note, I did this on less space, because I didn't write down some of the weird stuff. But if you go to the implementer's guide, you'll realize that there's weird stuff. Ta-da! Lots of cases, because you have to abort if you're outside, and you have to abort if it's negative, and anyway. But here it all is, and it's also written up here as well. So you can either reconstruct that from the places I said we have no intersection, which I didn't draw here, or you can look at the implementer's guide and see how it all fits together, or rederive it yourself. All right. So, we had triangle ray intersections in two parts, ray plane intersection followed by barycentric coordinates. We have our sphere or intersections, but notice I don't have any barycentric coordinates. I don't have anything, I just know a T. To render this, I will at least need to know the normal of the sphere at that point. And if I want to put a texture map, if I'm using the sphere to represent a planet or something, I will also need to know what textures to look up or some other information about the sphere. Okay? And so we need to find some more information once we're done here for many kinds of rendering. Unless, of course, we're just doing, you know, a metal ball and a glass ball, in which case all we need is the normal. But even then, we at least need the normal. The normal, fortunately, is really easy to find. Okay? So, let's do this on another. If I have a sphere, it has a center. It has a radius. I don't even need the radius for this. If I know I have some point on the boundary of the sphere, the normal at that point, the normal vector is just equal to q minus e. Normalize that if you want to make it unit length, and away you go. Ta-da! Life is easy. Okay? Then the most common thing like barycentric coordinates we get for this is latitude, longitude. And that's actually just based on the coordinates of n. So we take trig functions on the coordinates of n, we can get back latitude and longitude. And this is actually the kind of trig computers are best at. There's a function called atan2. I already know about atan2. That's less than half of you. Let's learn about atan2. All right. Let me go here. Man, atan2. All right. atan2, it exists in every language I've ever used. It takes two arguments, y and x, and returns the angle in sort of standard math terms to that point. Almost everybody I know says, why Hurst? And the answer is, I actually don't know why the answer is. It just is. I mean, this is based on the idea it's supposed to be the tangent of y over x, because that is what gives you this angle. This is a lot more efficient, both in computation and numeric precision ways, than taking the arctan of y over x. And this will give you back the angle in radians. Because, not because we love radians in computing, but because when you make infinite series to approximate these things and then turn them into code, you get back radians. And so that's what they give you, okay? So know that's what you're getting out. But what does this mean? Okay, I can give a y and an x and it'll give me the coordinates back, okay? So if I have some point here and I want to know what's this angle, this has a y, an x and a y, okay, at that point, and so I take the atan2 of y, x, and that will tell me this angle. Okay? And from that, I can get latitude, longitude by taking the atan2 of the appropriate portions of my normal vector. My normal vector gives me this. Okay? So we do x and y to get first our longitude. And then we take the magnitude of x, y, and z to get our latitude. And so we can work through this and get those back out. You could get other coordinate systems, but it turns out spheres are not easy to map onto planes. This may or may not come as a surprise. All right. Questions about spheres, triangles, ray intersections? Yes?
So what do you use the latitude and longitude?
Oh, well, that's a great question. Let's talk a little about homework 3, because I know you're all nearly done homework 2, right? So what do you use that for? So notice I only ask you to do, only require spheres, and then we have triangles and so on as electives. Where do we have texture mapped spheres? Somewhere down here. We use it to do things like this. Okay, you take three spheres, you draw one of them red, one of them with a moon texture, one of them earth texture, and poof. And that's mostly what you use it for. There are other things you can do. I've seen texture maps that are designed to make them look like soap bubbles by having like splotches of color instead of representing the thin film effect and diffraction. There's other reasons you might want to texture map your spheres. It's not super common. Other questions? All right. Let me just talk briefly, since I'm here and we only have a few minutes, not enough to get into what I was going to get to next. What do we ask to do in homework 3? Okay? I try to give you a lot of information so you know where you're going. I should comment, though, that homework 3 is going to be one where you'll think you have it all working, and then you'll get some picture you don't know what means. And like, something went wrong. What went wrong? And the answer is, I don't know. Okay, so I tried to give you a lot of information to help you out here, but you need all kinds of information to figure out how you generate your vectors, your arrays, and I give you some formulas for generating them that I say you should just use because I tried to get you to rederive these and you all look them different, so we've just given up. Here it is, here's the math, okay? And then we say you have to do ray collisions and you have to use Lambert's law. And so that means you must draw spheres, suns, and colors, and they should overlap. Not using a depth buffer. Okay, there isn't a depth buffer here. It's you find the closest collision. So that's how this works. And you go to draw this and you'll get like, it'll look like everything's inside out. That means you got the back collision instead of the front. Or maybe you computed your light wrong. Could be either one, right? Or like this sphere just isn't there, and you're like, what happened to that sphere? I don't know, right? Maybe you don't do well with small spheres. Maybe you did something wrong. Like, there's lots of places where small edits will make just confusing things. And we'll try, when you come to talk to me in office hours, we'll try to work through it. But I'm just trying to warn you, this is going to happen. And therefore, what should you do? You should go in here when something weird happens, and look at this and actually try to figure out what it looks like, which, I'm sorry, that's hard. Okay? Right? So sometimes what you want to do is say, okay, at least I know what color things are. So let's see, the red sphere isn't working. Let's comment out the red sphere. And do the other things still work, or was it the last sphere that doesn't work? Because you're going to be storing all your objects in a data structure, and so you might occasionally have, like, your data structure gets messed up. Anyway, there's lots of places this will go wrong. Sorry. Question.
So just to clarify, so for every pixel, you draw a ray for every object in the scene?
You do one ray per pixel, and you do one ray object intersection for each object ray pair. Yeah. So each ray tries to intersect every object. All right, and then we have you draw other things and inside things and texture coordinates and so on. And then we have this scene. Okay, this scene is designed to see if your compute code is very effective. Okay, and it won't be for most of you. I think we've had about 10% do this in the past. This is really, truly to speed it up. Okay, notice here, this works if you can do this 1001 spheres, two suns, and a shadow in less than a second. And yes, this is arbitrary wall clock time on our test server. Okay? So I thought there might as well be some time when I make sure that if you used a compiled language, you get some benefit. Right? So here it is, right? Yes, this does advantage you writing Python. Sorry. It isn't impossible in Python. We had one person do this in Python. Okay?
Why?
And so we'll talk about how you make thousands of things not take thousands of times longer. Probably next time. You had a question? Okay. Parallelism is not enough. If you just write your normal code and then thread it, I only have 16 cores, that won't make this happen. Just to warn you in advance. Okay? Probably, I think we had somebody that got to 1.2 seconds last time by having really efficient code and good threading. So it's really close, maybe if you're lucky, right? If you know how to use intrinsics well or something, you might get there. But the main way you do this is what's called a spatial bounding hierarchy. Okay? So let me give the very high-level overview of that now because we've got 1 minute left, and then we'll talk about a little bit more about these and mostly about lighting next time. Okay. I have lots of things in the scene. And I want to know how to draw them without checking each of them for intersection. The simple answer is I make more objects. This will make my life easier. How does it make my life easier? I make big objects that enclose other objects. Okay? And then I check to see if I hit the big object. If you hit the big object, then you go inside to all of the little objects it contained. So I make a big object that contains pointers to all of its little objects. I check all the big objects, I only check the little objects inside the big object if I hit the big object, otherwise I skip them all. But wait a minute, there's thousands of objects. How many big objects do I have? Ah, I'm glad you asked. I put more big objects inside the big object. And all the way down. This is a hierarchy. Okay? So I divide the world into a hierarchy of ever smaller objects containing other objects. This really truly turns it from linear in number of objects to logarithmic in number of objects in most scenes. And so it changes you approximately from a thousandfold down to, on the neighborhood, of tenfold work compared to a one object scene, if you do this properly. Okay? There's a whole lot of research into good bounding hierarchies and efficient graphics cards and so on that we probably won't get to unless you all think it's interesting later in the semester. That's the time I have. I will see you all on Tuesday. Yeah.